Discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It is 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 69th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, MDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music, played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. The song is actually off of an old Queen record, which I think is off the Miracle. It's a song called I Want It All. And since we're talking about going to be talking about hoarding tonight and folks wanting all of whatever they walks into their house, I thought this would be an appropriate lead-in.
Fair enough. Okay. As Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Hobbies and Collecting versus Hoarding, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so what I thought I would do tonight is to highlight an artist that a lot of studio folks and behind-the-scenes folks know, and a lot of major artists know, but the public is probably pretty unaware of this individual. Excuse me. So I thought I would give him a shout-out tonight. As it is coming up in about, a week or so, 9 days on his birthday. So I thought I'd give him a pre-birthday woohoo and kind of a plug, because he's a really fabulous musician. I'm talking about Robert Wachell, better known in the music business as Waddy Wachell, who is obviously, maybe not obviously, he's an American, born in, forget about it, in Jackson Heights, New York, and had begun playing at a very, very young age, took private lessons. It was interesting, as Waddy is a lefty, but he plays guitar right-handed because his first guitar teacher, who I believe his name was Gene Dell, insisted he play right-handed and say, no, we're not doing that left-handed crap. So he started out and learned to play right-handed, and then eventually started taking lessons under Rudolf Schramm, who at the time was, I think, the head of the NBC Staff Orchestra. And he has since gone on to teach music at Carnegie Hall and, Juilliard and all kinds of very prestigious places. Who wanted Waddy to take piano lessons. He's like, no, I'm doing guitar, so whatever you got, lay it on me on guitar. So he did, and I think he was taking something like 2 or 3 times a week with this guy, teaching him things on melody and harmony and rhythm and that sort of thing. So eventually, after playing in some local bands, he ends up with the attention of one of his bands that he had together, his own band. I think it was called Twice Nicely. And Bud Cowsill of, that's right, the Cowsills, heard about him and brought the band into L.A. to do some recording and demos, but it didn't quite fly, so he ended up staying as a session player and was kind of the mentor to Bud in terms of his guitar playing, and really did a lot of recordings with the Cowsills. Prior to that, he had done sessions, believe it or not, with the Everly Brothers, because of Warren Zevon, who was playing piano with them on their live tours, and had played with Waddy on some stuff and brought him into the sessions. And that's how he ended up being on Warren Zevon's records when he got a record deal. He also, most people don't know this, he also made an appearance on the original movie, The Poseidon Adventure, which I think was done in 72, where he's actually on stage playing with the band in the movie when the ship goes down. So,
oh, my God. With Marie McGovern?
Yeah, that's right. There's got to be a morning after pill, as I call it.
Oh, you're not a dad. You can't make dad jokes.
Mr. Bill. Right. Anyway, he's on that. He's playing with that band, which I just thought was a hoot. He's played on and done a lot of instruments for a shoot ton of movies, including the Cheech and Chong movie Up in Smoke, Joe Dirt, The House Bunny, Paul Blart, Mall Cop. I mean, he's done a bunch of stuff. He also plays all the Hendrix guitars on the Jimi Hendrix, a recent Jimi Hendrix movie called something like Life is All Good or something. I forget the name of it. Some weird name that just never made sense to me, but it's a Jimi Hendrix biop. And he's playing all the guitar parts on it. He's doing all the Jimi Hendrix stuff, but he does a really, really, really good job. But he's a really freaking fabulous guitar player. So he ends up playing with Warren and with Warren's band, off his first 3 or 4 records. I mean, he's the guitar player on Werewolves of London. So he's doing all of that guitar work. He also plays on Andrew Gold's Lonely Boy. He's the guy playing the backup band and all that solo work. But, I mean, this guy's played with Stevie Nicks. He was the touring band leader for Linda Ronstadt during her rock and roll days. What is that song? I can't think of it. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm having a blank, but he plays on all the rock stuff, all the early rock stuff. He's played on, he's done a lead guitar part on The Saint of Me, which is a Rolling Stone song off one of their records. He's done work with John Bon Jovi, Iggy Pop, Brian Ferry, for God's sake, Michael Sweet, Jackson, he's done a lot of work with Jackson Brown, Carla Bonoff, Joe Walsh, Fleetwood Mac, James Taylor, Buckingham Nicks before they became part of Fleetwood Mac, which is how he got in with Fleetwood Mac. He plays with Keith Richards' Expensive Winos and off Keith Richards' solo records. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's his spinoff band from the Stones. So, I mean, he is a well-known guy. But most of the public has no clue that he's the guy doing the lead solo part on all these records. They hear the records and they go, oh yeah, great guitar player, right? But he's also does a lot of production, so he's produced a lot of albums as well. Some of the Keith Richards stuff, the Jackson Brown stuff, the Stevie Nicks stuff. He's produced some of the George Thurgood and the Delaware Destroyers records, as well as Warren Zevon stuff. Yeah, so I mean, he's the co-author of Werewolves.
Oh.
Werewolves of London. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just done a lot of stuff. His typical guitars that he uses most often are either and the one I've seen him play most often is the Gibson Les Paul. It's a 1960, I think, and he plays a late 50s Fender Strat as well. So, I mean, this guy has just been all around. He was one of the band leaders at the 2010 Grammys. So if you see the Grammy where Cat Stevens was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he's directing the band for all that stuff.
Wow.
I mean, this guy has a huge portfolio of people and things he's done. He's just he's a force. He's just a really, really, really great guitar player. And just a lot, like I say, a lot of those folks just don't know it. He's even played on Steve Perry's solo record, Street Talk. So, I mean, he's done a lot of stuff. There is no, slack bones in that man's body. I wanted to put a shout out for him since his birthday's coming up, near the end of this month. And I wanted to, give him a shout out because he is very known by the general public, even though most musicians, both famous and infamous, and studio guys are very familiar with his work. He's, like I said, he has quite a catalog. Just wanted to put the shout out for that.
Okay, cool. Well, let's wish him a happy birthday. Definitely mad appreciation for all that stuff that he's done. Apparently, the man gets around. No pun intended.
Yep, that is absolutely true. Yeah,
true.
And he doesn't get around because he sucks either. So just FYI.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okie dokie. All right, well, thanks for that. And again, we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called Hobbies and Collecting versus Hoarding. It is a safe assumption that the majority of people in our society enjoy participating in one or more personal hobbies. Tonight we're going to focus on a specific subset of hobbies, namely collecting, as well as some ways in which this activity might or could potentially trigger some psychological disorders in some people, such as hoarding. Tonight we will discuss what is the purpose of having hobbies in our lives and, the psychology of hobbies. And then we will discuss why are some of us drawn to collecting specifically as a hobby. Then how do you know if you've gone too far into, for example, hoarding behavior, or a couple of other disorders that I'll mention in the third section. And then lastly, we'll talk a little bit about resources and how to get help for hoarding and related disorders. And I'll let you guys know now as a little bit of a spoiler, there are not a lot of resources for this, but I will tell you what is usually recommended that you do if you think there's a legitimate psychological problem going on. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to bring up before we get started.
No, we're good.
All right, I like it when we're good. Okay, so question number one, what is the purpose of having hobbies in our lives? Let's talk about the psychology of hobbies. So first, let's talk about the role that having hobbies plays in our lives from the perspective of our psychological and emotional well-being, as well as intellectual support and stimulus. What is a hobby? According to Wikipedia, and yes, I use Wikipedia, and even though we know some of the data is spurious, but this is a dictionary definition, and it's pretty much in alignment with everything. They say, a hobby is a regular activity done for enjoyment, typically during one's leisure time. Hobbies include collecting themed items and objects, engaging in creative and artistic pursuits, playing sports, or pursuing other amusements. A pastime, by the way, on the other hand, is something one does casually just to occupy a bit of time with any random activity, whereas a hobby is a dedicated choice to repeatedly pursue, hone, or expand the same enjoyable activity, increasing expertise, knowledge, and variety within the same activity. And that's the difference. Here are some examples of the benefits that any hobbies can provide us. It'll depend on the hobby, some of these more than others. Hobbies can teach us a new skill, as well as general skills like research, patience, or cooperation. Hobbies can improve our creativity and imagination. They can improve our athletic ability and health if sports or other physical pursuits like hiking or dance are involved. They can improve our critical thinking and reasoning skills if games, puzzles, or collecting hobbies are involved. They encourage us to take regular breaks from work, stressors, and other tedium. They encourage us to be excited about and interested in something outside of ourselves. They provide us with positive, healthy challenges. They provide an opportunity to connect to others with similar interests, if you want. They promote focusing on the moment instead of fretting about the past or the future. So in a way, hobbies teach us mindfulness. They help alleviate boredom. They can provide people with a sense of purpose about their leisure time. Next, I want to read you a couple clips from an article on the health benefits of having hobbies. I've really distilled these down instead of posting most of it here. This one was called How Hobbies Impact Your Head and Your Heart. New research explains how hobbies can help you feel happier and younger. This was posted June 20th, 2017 on psychologytoday.com by Sweeney Pillay, MD, who has been a physician for 25 years, maintains an active clinical practice, and teaches medical students as assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He has expertise in the neurochemistry of panic and anxiety disorders. There are excerpts from his posts, other studies that concur with his own conclusions, and these are snips from those. He cites physiology professor Robert Root Bernstein, who's a professor of physiology at Michigan State. Art fosters scientific success, avocations of Nobel, National Academy, Royal Society, and Sigma Chi members in Journal of Psychology of Science and Technology. He, being Professor Root Bernstein, found that hobbies involve visual thinking, imagining, learning from doing rather than just thinking, and art and music were particularly advantageous. Key to their success, however, was the fact that they, these are the people who have the hobbies, that they saw their hobbies or dabbling activities as having some purpose. That was very important. The next study that he quoted that agrees is entitled Engagement in Reading and Hobbies and Risk of Incident Dementia, the Movies Project, by aging researcher, not that the researcher is aging, but that the researcher looks at stuff about aging. T.F. Hughes, written in August 2010, and the study says one or more hours per day on hobbies may counter or delay dementia. Another study found that having a hobby may also result in your being more functional when you are older and living longer. This study was Relationship of Having Hobbies and a Purpose in Life with mortality, activities of daily living, and instrumental activities of daily living among community-dwelling elderly adults by Kei Tomioka, N. Kurumatani, and H. Hosoi. And this was done in March 2016. And their conclusions said that although effect modifications by cognitive functioning and depression cannot be ruled out, our findings suggest that having hobbies and PIL, and I'm sorry, I didn't write down what that, purpose in life. Oh, thank God that's in the title. Having hobbies and a purpose in life may extend not only longevity, but also healthy life expectancy among community-dwelling older adults. And another comment further down the article, enjoyable leisure activities are associated with lower blood pressure, smaller waist circumference, and a lower body mass index. People also feel better physically and are less likely to be depressed. Now, this is my personal lay opinion. I kind of want to push back on that just a tiny bit. I don't feel like some of the studies dealt enough with correlation and causality. I kind of feel like if you're having physiological problems of those sorts, you kind of don't have the energy to do hobbies. So I don't, it's chicken and egg going on in there. And I think you got to be careful about these conclusions a little bit. But all things being said, if you pursue hobbies, you definitely have some physiological benefits because you are not getting cortisol poisoning and you're moving around and you're enjoying yourself, and these things all impact your health. So overall, it is best for any and everyone's personal, mental, and physical health to make time to engage in at least one or two personal hobbies for all of the above reasons. And I'm going to check in with you here, Dr. Mathis, and see if you want to add anything.
Doesn't take a lot of energy to sit on your assets and play guitar. And I joke about it, but I'm serious because that's what I did when I was chronically ill. That's how I got started playing guitar, as a distractor and something I could do without venturing outside and get sick. Because I would look at the weather. It was ridiculous. You can also do stamp collecting and coin collecting and modeling and that sort of thing without having to physically have a hobby like high lie or football or windsurfing or whatever. I mean, certainly those are going to be better for you physically, but there's some folks who just can't do that for a variety of reasons. So,
yeah. And, if you pursue something that makes you happy, you may start finding you have some changes that make the other stuff possible later. Some people.
And that's what happened. Yeah.
There you go. All righty. So the next thing that we want to talk about is why are some of us drawn to collecting as a hobby? So what is the specific appeal of collecting things as a hobby? According to Wikipedia, quote, psychologists have often taken a Freudian perspective when describing why people collect. They highlight the controlling and impulsive dark side to collecting, the need for people to have an object of desire. This desire, and hence the innate propensity to collect, begin at birth. The infant first desires the emotional and physical comfort of the nourishing breast, then the familiar baby blanket the child clings to for comfort and security. Stuffed animals, favorite toys are taken to bed and provide the emotional security needed to fall asleep. A sense of ownership and control is facilitated through possession of these items for the vulnerable child. Freud himself took a more extreme position on the origin of collecting. Pardon my snickering. Not surprisingly, he postulated that all collecting stems from unresolved toilet training conflict. Freud took the stance that the loss of bowel control was a traumatic experience and the product from the bowels was disgusting and frightening to the child. Therefore, the collector is trying to gain back control of their bowels as well as their, quote, possessions, which were long flushed down the toilet. Where Freud linked object fixation to the anal retentive stage in childhood, Munsterberger, in his perspective paper Unruly Passion, believes that collecting to be a need-driven compensatory behavior where every new object effectively gives the notion of fantasized omnipotence. Jung had his own theories about why people become collectors. He touted the influences of archetypes on behavior. These universal symbols are embedded in what he termed our collective unconscious. Using this logic, collecting and completing sets have as their archetypal antecedents the collecting of nuts and berries once needed for survival by our early ancestors. End quote. And I am not implying that we necessarily on this show fully agree here with those looks, these takes on it. We're just pointing out various iconic psychologists' view on it. I'm going to stop here and see if Dr. Mathis would like to jump in.
Why, yes, I would. The only people that really believe that are the diehard Freudians, and most of them are dying out, which is a good thing. Oops, did I say that? That was my unmedicated voice. Yeah, modern-day psychology people don't believe that at all. At all.
Yeah.
Only the diehard psychoanalysts believe that crap, frankly. And that's what it is, in my personal opinion.
Yeah. And we're going to, in the next section, read some things that are a little newer that I think will be more in alignment with how it is seen today.
Yeah, yes, that is correct.
Okay. So, as I mentioned, here are some more recent takes on this. Collecting in specific has its own appeal to people as an activity. Here are some of the compelling aspects. Some of the first few of these are taken from The Psychology of Collecting, April 2016 by Shirley Muller, MD from mdmag.com. And some of the rest of these are various places on the internet. So these are some of the compelling aspects of collecting. A sense of history, creating or reuniting a legacy. A set of something that was once scattered. Collecting may provide psychological security by filling a part of the self that one feels is missing or is void of meaning. It gives you the opportunity to craft a sense of order. It gives intellectual stimulation. Other collectors feel a sense of history when they assemble objects. By, for example, owning antiques, they feel closer to cherished bygone days or perhaps even dead ancestors or important people or circumstances of long ago. They relive their childhood, a beloved object destroyed, broken, or lost, connect to a future self that never yet happened, such as a thwarted career. They can experience the pride of ownership. They can receive social rewards for their hobby. Some collectors enjoy belonging to hobby clubs and the camaraderie of a shared interest and pursuit, even the friendly competition of it. Some collectors of celebrity memorabilia have a connection to that artist's work or their fame, or just want to vicariously share in their status. They experience status or bragging rights of obtaining a rare item or the recognition of having found it. The anticipation of buying special pieces fuels the primitive pleasure center in the brain called the nucleus accumbens. Did I do it right?
We have a wiener.
Yay. We've talked about different parts of the brain where a lot of these pathologies come from. And all this stuff comes from the limbic system, which they actually mentioned on the page, which is part of the primitive brain. It is shown above in red in a graphic that you guys can't see. It is composed of the nucleus accumbens, which is pleasure center, the insula, and the amygdala, which is a fear, where fear comes from, among other components. And all these enter into the impulses that ultimately end up causing us to want to collect stuff. When one collects, one experiments with arranging, organizing, and presenting a part of the world which may serve to provide a safety zone, a place of refuge where fears are calmed and insecurity is managed. These are not mutually exclusive reasons either. Most collectors do it for a combination of several of the above reasons. And I'm going to pause here and check in with Dr. Mathis on that.
Yeah, the amygdala is actually an emotional regulator, so it's also in charge of things like fear and anger. And the hippocampus being the other one, which is an emotional memory component, which is also part of the limbic system. So it remembers certain emotional events, like the first time you ever saw Elvis on TV or the Beatles or Frank Sinatra or whatever your thing is. And then you want to be a, you know, if you're a musician and you want to own a guitar that's like the one Paul McCartney played, or the one like Elvis, you know, had, or Scotty Moore, his guitar player, or whatever. So it's that kind of projective identification kind of thing. You know, and it also gives you a piece of history. You know, it connects you to something bigger than yourself when you own a piece of something that was owned by something famous, which is, you know, a corner of the Declaration of Independence that broke off, and you have a piece of the paper, or you own a guitar that was made, or a nightstand that was made from a part of a Liberty tree after it got hit by lightning, and now you have a coffee table that's got part of that in it. It's part of history. It's a connection with your past. It's a connection, you know, with your ancestry. And you're right, it is for, it is not for one reason. It's for a multiplicity of reasons. You know, so it, and it's different for everybody, it, you know, but you have to balance it. And, you know, that's, we've talked about this before. It's all about balance in life. That's everything. So if you have, you know, a collection thing going on, you got to make sure it doesn't become an obsession, because it could very easily do that. And I'm speaking from experience.
Personally. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, I know.
Nice,
yeah, I know.
Nice first floor office, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I definitely understand that. I have my own several things that I collect, and there's several things on this list that I actually do collect, you know, celebrity memorabilia, for example. You know, yeah. I kind of enjoy that, especially as I'm getting older. I'm kind of getting a kick out of the fact that some celebrities and artisans of my youth who were not part of like convention culture and that sort of thing and social media at that time, because it didn't really exist so much. They're coming back now, and you know, they're having reunions of the cast of such and such from the 60s or whatever. And I get a big kick out of that stuff. And, you know, sometimes it provides interesting little anecdotes when it happens. And for example, I went to Dragon Con down in Atlanta a few years ago, getting almost up on 10. And they had an I Dream of Jeannie reunion. And that is not a cast that has typically done the convention circuit too much. And I managed to get in there, and I managed to get one of the first cast photos together with them in the Jeannie bottle. And by God, it was just a few months later. We thought for sure Bill Daly was going to be the first to go, and we lost Larry Hagman right after that.
Right.
So that was, had I not gone, that would have been the end of that opportunity. And it was wonderful.
Yep.
But, you know, now I have a little story about the getting of that. And I've actually got the bottle in my office. I'm looking right at it right now. But these are fun things, you know, and you kind of have to figure out, you know, why are you doing it? I mean, if you're actually, let's go ahead and go to section three, because section three is going to be about when these things can go a little dark or a little off. And, you know, that's kind of how this episode started, is it was requested because I think there's a couple people that follow our show that were struggling as to whether the, either themselves or somebody they're close to was going a little too far with some of this. So let's go ahead and talk about that in section three. How do you know if you've gone too far into hoarding behavior? And I'm not just going to talk about hoarding. I'm going to talk about a couple of ways in which these hobbies can go a little off. So if you're ever having doubts as to whether yourself or a loved one may no longer be a collector, but rather a hoarder, that is probably a reliable first warning sign. However, sometimes there are just hobbyist collectors who are extreme about their passion. Oh, my God. And if you look at our website, you know, with the chat room tonight, you know, they have a round table of pictures that go around. And I have pictures of some of these extreme collectors. And it's an avocation, how much time they spend organizing these things. But, you know, they're not a giant trash pile in the living room. They're, the whole barn is taken up with something, but it's orderly and it's labeled and it's pretty. And I don't have that kind of time. More power to y'all. So you have hobbyists that are extreme, but they're managing the activity to no personal detriment. That's really key. So let's examine a few professional opinions for more specifics, though. When collecting hobbies have become out of control, there are three big general blanket areas. One, if you exceed your physical or virtual space for managing them, you know, typically hoarding. If you don't have room for stuff anymore, you have a problem. And this can be virtual as well. Like if you are constantly downloading pictures or movies or media, and every time you turn around a couple times a year, you have to buy a new hard drive, you may want to think about these things. Virtual is more easily managed, thank God, but even that has its limits because hard drive space can get expensive after a while. The second way it can go a little funny is if you're exceeding your income and recreational budget to procure them to the detriment of other necessary things. Or if you're somebody who buys stuff and then completely forgets about it or that you did it. You see stories about, you know, so-and-so bought a thing on, you know, one of those TV channels for buying stuff, you know, Shop Network or whatever, and completely forgotten they've got five of the same damn thing sitting in the closet because they forget. That's actually borderline possibly a pathology, but just keep an eye on that sort of stuff. So that's more about compulsion. And there's a note here I want you guys to remember. The DSM-5 dropped compulsive buying disorder, CBD, also known as oniomania, as an addiction. The ICD-10 called it an impulse control disorder. I do not know what the ICD-11 said. And I believe, and Dr. Mathis, feel free to correct me if you actually know, I believe this has been sort of flipped into a general impulse control problem, you know, without a real specific stated, so that they can get a code on it, and that's about it. Is that basically how they handle it?
Unless it falls into a full-blown OCD, yes.
Yes. Did they not eliminate the OCD angle, or is that still considered valid?
Well, if you meet the criteria, if you meet the criteria for OCD, full criteria for OCD, then that sort of trumps hoarding. It's like a more serious disorder, for lack of a better term. It's like if you have oppositional defiant disorder and then you meet the criteria for conduct disorder, that trumps oppositional defiant. Congratulations, you've graduated to conduct disorder, which is one step away from antisocial personality disorder.
Yeah.
You're moving up the ladder.
Yay, I graduated. So, you know, I did see some commentary about how there's a subset of people that hoard that do actually meet the criteria for OCD as well. And there was a lengthy explanation about the relationship, but I didn't bring it in tonight because it was kind of a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Now you're gonna confabulate the dilly if you do that. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. That's why I decided to skip it. But just so you guys know, that is a thing. Sometimes if you do want to know about that, go look it up because there's plenty out there. I just didn't think we had time for it. And the third way that this can go funny is if your hobby consumes so much of your time that it does harm to your work, your health, your safety, and or your interpersonal relationships, and that kind of comes under obsession. And I guess pathologically, if it's extreme enough, you might get back into an impulse control thing from a different angle. You know, if it's not really hoarding, but if you're spending 14 hours a day cataloging G.I. Joe and you don't talk to your son, you need to get professional help. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and stop here and see if there's anything you'd like to add before we continue. I know we're in the middle of the section, but that's okay.
Well, yeah, what I would say is look at it like, when it gets to that point, look at it like an addiction, because that's really what it is. And if you look at some of these criteria, there's some of the very similar criteria you find for an addictive compulsive, an addictive behavior that is drug-related. Like or a non-addictive behavior like gambling, a non-drug addictive behavior like gambling. So if it looks like a drug addiction, it's an addiction, then you got a problem. You know, I often joke about the difference between hoarding and collecting. You know, because some people go, well, I'm just a really good collector. Well, that's fine, but are you, you know, messing up your job, or you're messing up your social stuff, you're messing up your school, you're messing up your finances, your living space, yada, yada, yada. Because if you are, now you have an addiction. And sort of my standing joke is, what's the difference in a collector, an avid collector and a hoarder? Well, part of it is a collector is a discriminative hoarder.
Well,
hoarders, I mean, I joke about it, but that's actually true. So if true hoarders will hoard anything, and I mean anything, you know,
yeah.
newspapers, you know, used toilet tissue, whatever.
Yeah.
Collectors usually only collect certain things, and they're very snooty about it. But if you're a snooty collector and you don't have enough money and you're spending your rent money, now you're an addict. So you might be a snooty collector and a discriminating collector, but you're still a discriminating collector who's now fully blown an addict. So you need to get a lid on your head.
Gotcha. And you know, does that? I'm glad you brought that up because we are going to talk about that a bit in section four when we get to like how to deal with this. Because spoiler alert, I kind of found like there's not a lot of resources for this, and the ones that are very 12-step heavy. So I know you're going to twitch.
Yeah. Well, I'll be glad to talk about that if somebody wants to hear about that when we get to that section.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. So we are definitely going to poke that bear again.
Okay.
All right. So the next article, as far as, you know, when is it hoarding? When are you going over the edge? Is an article normal or not? When Collecting Becomes Hoarding by Wynn Perry. And that was in May of 2013 at LifeScience.com. And she says, perhaps, this is an excerpt also, perhaps the piles of newspapers, almost working appliances, or old Barbie dolls start out as part of a harmless if eccentric collection. Or perhaps they are items on a languishing to-do list. But as the clutter builds, it can become pathological. Until the release of the new mental health, well, not new now, the new mental health manual, the fifth edition of the DSM, hoarding was considered to be part of OCD. But the APA task force behind the newest version of the manual is given the compulsion to excessively collect things without value, its own diagnosis. People with what is now known as hoarding disorder hang on to items because they fear they will need them at some point in the future. They may also feel excessively attached to or overvalue the worth of these possessions. Quote, a collector, in theory, will sell or cull a collection when they don't have enough room for all the objects, Rosenberg said. A hoarder will just fill the room, literally fill the room to the brim. Accumulated junk also creates habitat for insects and other pests. Quote, it is often a little bit made fun of in films, but as an actual disorder, it is not funny, Rosenberg said. People can really be crippled by their inability to throw things away, and it is a safety hazard. The next article is, what's the difference between hoarding and collecting? December 30th, 2018, Australian Institute of Family Counseling. And they have their take on hoarding versus collecting. Collectors have a passion for gathering things as a side interest, like stamps, antiques, model cars, and collectibles. Many things can be collected. It's totally up to the individual what they choose to collect. Collections create communities of individuals who share similar passions and interests. Collectors will organize and display their items proudly, showcasing them for others to see. Hoarders lose their capacity to show these things in a sorted out way and end up obstructing on the ordinary use of living areas in their home. Instead of a living space, the home has turned into a storage facility. Part of the portrayal for habitual hoarders' homes incorporates semi-blocked and blocked entryways. It is exceptionally hard to navigate through the spaces from one room to the next without stepping over the mess they've created. Hoarders have the extreme inability to discard worthless objects and usually live in squalor. Most hoarders prefer to be known as collectors rather than hoarders, although they have an intense emotional attachment to the items they own. Hoarders frequently become isolated in their own homes and suffer from depression and anxiety. Studies conducted in Australia show that 46% of people with hoarding disorder share their homes with someone else. And hoarding disorder can affect people of any age. Second to last article, 10 Reasons You Buy Things That You Don't Need, published May 9th, 2016 by Lauren Grootman. And this is just a little bit about the people that compulsively buy stuff and they don't need to have it. They might not even remember they bought it, but there's this compulsion to buy. And I wanted to get these to speak to that. And Lauren says, so how does one stop buying more junk? How does one go about actually doing this? And to avoid buying things we don't need, you've got to dig deeper. You've got to understand the root of it because it's all emotional and psychological. And I'm going to read you a list of 10 things. Lauren doesn't actually say how to fix it, but she's gesturing at the fact that you're doing this because there's an emotional thing going on and you got to figure out what that's feeding. So the surface reasons you do this, you want to impress people. You're just in the habit. You don't think through what you already have before you purchase. You're depressed and you get a high from purchasing stuff. You're a tidbit selfish. You are exposed to too much advertising. You feel that more stuff will give you a greater degree of security. You might want to keep up with your friends and family. You neglect creative solutions to your problems, or even just more simplistic ones. And some people think more stuff is an investment in your future. And salesmen love to say this crap, especially about stuff like cars and washing machines and shit. And the last part is recent research suggests that nearly 1 in 5 compulsive hoarders have non-hoarding OCD symptoms. Here we go, the thing we talked about earlier. Compulsive hoarding is also considered a feature of obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, OCPD, and may develop along with other mental illnesses such as dementia and schizophrenia. My source for this was the International OCD Foundation. And I will pause here and check in with you, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. So if you have somebody who has OCPD, such as myself, you are more prone to kind of get, you know, crazy with this kind of stuff. So you have to check yourself at when you start to, if you're a collector person, as I am, you have to really kind of check yourself and, you know, put the skids on yourself and give yourself some filters so that you're not just impulsively throwing money at stuff that comes your way. And I joke with a lot of my patients about this thing, you know, and they talk about, well, you know, I have this impulse stuff and, you know, whatever, whether it's anger impulse or whatever. And I go, yeah, I get that. But there's things you can do to build in to rein yourself in if you're in a situation where you think you might act out in some way, whether it's sexual acting out or anger acting out or spending acting out. It's all acting out behavior, right? So, you know, and they say, well, what do you mean? And I go, well, one of the things I do when I go to a music store is I leave my wallet and my credit cards in my car. And I have a 2-week rule. So if I go into a music store and I see this really cool gear that I go, oh, my God, that's awesome. Oh, you know, I want it. You can't have it. to quote a line from, yeah, well, I had to do a nod to The Who. What can I tell you, right?
Yeah, I knew that was.
So, yeah, I will allow myself to play it and do whatever, but if I play it and it plays really well and it sounds good and it looks pretty to me, you know, it's all subjective, and then I have the 2-week rule. So then I go home, I go, well, that's real nice, thank you very much for your time, and then I go home and I think about it for 2 weeks. And if I decide it's still something I'm interested, then I go back and go through the routine again just to make sure I'm not overly whatever's. And then I start dickering about the price. So it has to look good, play well, sound good, has to pass the 2-week rule, and then I have to get it for a good price. And if all those are not in place, it stays in the store. And that's just my rules to myself. And, I mean, I went into a very high-end store here in Atlanta that I have bought several things from in the past. And they had a very expensive guitar in there that was gorgeous. And I played it, and it sounded pretty good. And it was a great price. And I played it, and it sounded pretty well, pretty good acoustically. But the pickup system in it was an acoustic electric. The pickup system didn't sound that great. And I went, well, okay then. Thank you very much. And it's still sitting at the store, and it was going to be sitting there until somebody else buys it. You know, and it's a gorgeous guitar. It is beautiful. But you have to put a lid on your shit. There has to be some filter that you use to keep yourself from going ape with this stuff. You know, conversely, I had played guitar in there probably a week earlier, two guitars in there actually a week earlier. And I was like, oh, these are really cool. And they played well and they sounded good. And I didn't even talk price with them. And they looked really good. And I said, okay, well, fine. It's time for the two-week rule. And I said, thank you very much. That was very kind. And I walked out the door. So in another week and a half, 2 weeks, I'll go back and play them again if I'm still interested and go, okay, well, you know. And I, you know, but I think about it. I give my prefrontal lobes time to put a check on my amygdala hippocampus, right? So I let my prefrontals rule my emotional brain as opposed to vice versa. And that's the problem these people have. They don't have a lid on their limbic system, and I do. But, you know, if you're OCPD, if you're a really good self-respecting OCPD guy, you've got good control over that limbic system, let me tell you. And so that's just little things I build into my routine so that I don't go crazy and spend like a son of a biscuit eater. You know, it's things I do. And the only exception to that is if I go in and I see a piece of gear that is clearly, you know, classic, collectible, oh my freaking God, and at some ridiculous price that the guy or gal doesn't know what he or she has, and they're selling it, they're blowing it out, and I'm like, and I play it, and I go, okay, now you're coming with me. And then I go back to the car and get the credit card. But that's reserved only for uber collectible items that I knew if I got desperate, I could turn around tomorrow and sell for 3 or 4 or 10 times their value. But that doesn't happen very often. Most people that have that kind of gear know what they have.
Fair enough. Okay, so last section is kind of, you know, going a little bit further into this same conversation. Resources and how to get help for hoarding and related disorders. So if you feel or others close to you have suggested that your collecting hobby concerns them in some damaging way, such as what we've discussed tonight, here are some suggestions for help coping with reframing your recreation in a healthy manner. And I will be honest with you guys, there is not a lot here, but this is what I could gather together that I felt was of any value. One issue with many resources for shopping compulsion help that is that a great many of them are based on the 12-step disease model of addiction, like, Shoppers Anonymous or something like that,
right.
Aside from this not being an addiction, and that contradicts what you said earlier, but, you know, how you and I have talked about addiction, it's not really, is a flawed model to cope with addiction. Listeners might consider contacting some of the rational recovery style groups we mentioned in our recent episode on the 12-step program flaws and see if they might be willing to work with you. You know, if you want to treat it as an addiction, don't go the 12-step model way. And that may give you fewer options, but I don't want to recommend that you guys go off in a way that we think is deeply flawed. You're wasting your time. And I think you're just going to be doing the same crap in 5 years. Hoarding, on the other hand, is a recognized disorder in the DSM-5, though it can be complicated to treat. Cognitive behavior therapy is the most common form of psychotherapy used to treat hoarding disorder. There are no known medications that help very much, except perhaps to address some of the extreme anxiety that is often comorbid with the hoarding. The conclusion is that there really are no good websites or groups for coping with any of these pathologies outside of CBT and psychologist sessions, except possibly any non-12-step recovery groups, which may be willing to branch out and help. And I'm going to pause here and see if you have anything to suggest, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, CBT is definitely the way to go, or anybody using a CBT-like approach. The other thing that's really good with this is mindfulness training. And so if you combine mindfulness training with some form of cognitive training, whether it's CBT, DBT, cognitive therapy, whatever, the two of those together are very, very potent hand-in-hand tactics for coping with any kind of hoarding-esque, addictive, collecting-esque behavior.
Good. Okay. I was thinking it was a little ironic that there are some hobbies that kind of promote mindfulness, but if your hobby's getting out of control, I don't think you can rely on your hobby to give you that mindfulness. You may have to try another way.
Well, the thing is, you lose your perspective. You know, you forget that the whole purpose of it is to relax and get a peace of mind, not to become so compulsive that you're ruminating about it all the time. And sometimes that's a tricky line, you know.
Yeah. No. That's fair. Okay. So, in conclusion, we hope now that our listeners are confident in knowing the value of hobbies, because I know some of you out there are like, oh, I work 80 hours a week, I can't do that crap. And, you know, if you call us up in a couple years and you haven't had a heart attack, I will be very shocked. So you need to take some downtime. In specific, I hope you understand the positive aspects of collections as a hobby while being mindful of any behavior disorders that could become connected to doing so. So at this point, this concludes our show on hobbies and collecting versus hoarding. And I'm going to check in with you again, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything in general about the topic that you'd like to get into before we wrap.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, May 29th, 11 o'clock EDT, right here on blogtalkradio.com. As I've just mentioned, our own upcoming shows include that Wednesday show. It will be episode 70 for us. And the topic currently at this time, we probably need to talk about this off the air, but I have slated to do a show dedicated to the cluster Bs, your favorite, narcissists, APD, histrionics, and borderlines. We've Woo-hoo. Talked about them in little pieces on a whole bunch of our shows, but we've never dedicated a whole show to them. So these little attention whores are going to get their own thing. I'm being a little bit detrimental right now, but this is a very toxic axis. So we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. And then we'd like to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. A week from today, Wednesday the 22nd at 7 p.m. EDT, Best Barbecue North of Texas. Lake George, New York is famed for its atmosphere, either relaxed or active, your choice. It's terrific for families, couples, singles, LGBTQI, in short, everybody is welcome. There are excursions on a paddle wheel boat, fantastic brisket barbecue at the Barn Cider, in winter nearby skiing or dog sledding on the frozen lake. Join us as we talk with Melissa and Ed Pagnotta, who are owners of the Barn Cider restaurant where Ed dishes out the barbecue. And as we mentioned before, Sunday the 2nd of June, the Fear the Walking Dead online viewing party starts up Season 5, Episode 1, titled To Be Announced. That's my other show that I do. And also, very important, you guys, grab a pen and paper if you are anywhere near South Carolina. Dr. Mathis is going to be conducting an in-person free nutrition seminar at University of South Carolina, Sumter. The seminar is entitled Better Living Through Chemistry, Nutrition for a Healthy Mind and Body. So to reserve a free spot at the seminar, it's this Sunday coming up. Contact Debbie Bowen, 803, this is the phone number, so write this down, 803-468-4291, or Richard Cleveland, 803-316-4616, to reserve a spot, and it's free to attend, but they probably have a seating capacity, so you need to let them know you're coming. Bring your friends, tell your friends. Contact me on the Facebook page if you don't understand this or you need help navigating that. So we'd love to see you guys come.
I sent you a flyer. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I sent you a flyer on this just a minute ago. You can push that up, and it's being held in the Schwartz Building, the seminar room there at USC Sumter, and it's from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. As you said, it is completely and totally free, and all the attendees are going to get a handout that I've created that they'll be able to take home with them. It's 123 pages.
Oh, homework. Yay. Thank you.
No. It's a reference. I would not be
reference
that cruel.
Guide.
It's a reference manual they can keep with them to document stuff. So when they go looking for food choices and that kind of stuff, they have a reference thing that they do. And I want to mention real quickly that Ms. Bowen is footing the bill for all of this. She's paid for all of this out of her own pocket. And she and Mr. Cleveland has donated some of his resources and time and money as well. So they're doing this as a public service to the community. So they really get a woohoo pat on the back for that. That's something that's completely, you know, above and beyond the call of duty. And I really have a lot of respect for Ms. Bowen. She's the one that came and approached me about doing this. So yeah, kudos to her and for Mr. Cleveland for coming in and helping her out. So it should be a fun time. It's a 3-hour thingy, and there'll be breaks every hour and refreshments and that kind of thing. So come on down.
Yes. Well, let's give them a woohoo for putting this on. Thank you, guys.
Come yeah, on. Absolutely.
There it goes. Very appreciative of that opportunity. So, you know, feel free to, and like I said, if you guys miss this, you can get the episode as an MP3 and play this back, or contact the Facebook page and I can help you out navigate through that. It's going to be this Sunday, just so you know. And the date on that is the 19th. So come
yep.
on down. All righty. Anything else before we go? Are we good?
Yeah, we're good.
Fabulous.
Yeah, I would say if any of our listeners show up, please come up to the podium and say hi and go, hey, I heard your show. You're nuts, but I thought you had something cool to say, so I showed up. And
yeah,
that would
look
really
for the
be
mouthy
cool.
blonde, though. I'm up in D.C. That's a little bit far from Sumter. All right. So thank you, guys. Please look for us on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We are on iTunes and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. So thanks, everybody. Good night and rock on.